Oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has four matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060040, N. Ray Robert Francis, and that is consolidated for argument with number 060042, N. Ray the Honorable Charles Holcomb. Justice Willett is not sitting in these original proceedings. Docket number 041039, Cooper Tire and Rubber Company versus Oscar Mendez Jr. et al. From El Paso County and the 8th Court of Appeals District, and 041119, N. Ray Applied Chemical Magnesius Corporation, an original proceeding. In the first two matters, the court has allotted 15 minutes for each relator and real party in interest. In the remaining arguments, the court has allotted 20 minutes per side. The court will take a brief recess between each argument, and we expect all arguments to be concluded before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060040, N. Ray Robert Francis, consolidated for argument with 060042, N. Ray the Honorable Charles Holcomb.
May I please the court? Mr. Robert Heath will present argument for relator Honorable Charles Holcomb. Relator Holcomb is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Deborah Hankinson will present argument for relator Robert Francis. Relator Francis is reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Judge Holcomb has raised constitutionality of the specific petition signature requirement of Section 172.021G, a requirement that applies to statewide judges, 18 people, but not to non-judicial candidates. Now, there's a long line of U.S. Supreme Court cases that deal with ballot access issues. But this court, in Brady versus 14th Court of Appeals about 15 years ago, discussed those cases, brought them together, summarized them, and set out the constitutional test that those cases provide.
Mr. Heath, what's the purpose of the statute that applies only to the major parties, the Democrat and Republican parties, and not the so-called minor parties? What's the state's interest in that?
Well, we don't think the state has an interest in that. We think that is something that is purely irrational, because that's exactly what the state does. And it has to have, by the way, a compelling state interest to justify this statute, because we're talking about fundamental rights, and that's the test. And they apply just to people who are running on the Democratic or Republican tickets. If I want to run as a Libertarian candidate for Justice of the Supreme Court or Judge of the Court of Appeals, I don't have to have a single signature in order to get on the ballot. Now, the reason is they nominate by convention system, not a primary system. But if it's to show that you have some statewide support individually, if that's what the test is, it certainly is not narrowly tailored to apply to the Democrats and the Republicans and not the Libertarians.
Similarly, in State Against Hodges, we said that candidacy is not a fundamental right.
Well, but that may be the case, but in Bullock versus Carter, and I think, again, summarizing in Brady as it was summarizing those, indicates that when you're looking at ballot access requirements, that the rights of the candidate and the rights of the voter are inextricably combined, and you have to look at them together, and that there are fundamental interests that are at issue under the First Amendment, and those are expressive rights and associational rights. And so it's the combination of the two that requires a compelling state interest, and federal courts, I think, have been fairly strong on that. But one of the things is, of course, that this is something that applies to Republicans and Democrats, not to Libertarians. Also, it applies to judges, but not to the governor, the lieutenant governor, members of the Railroad Commission. And there's a case that was decided in Pennsylvania, a federal case, it's federal district court. It was affirmed summarily by the Third Circuit, called Patriot Party of Pennsylvania. And in that case, you had a petition requirement for judges, and you also had a petition requirement for other offices such as president and governor. And the way the statute worked, it ended up requiring a lot more signatures to get on the ballot as a judge than it did for president or governor. And the court said there is absolutely no basis for making that decision. You know, there is no compelling interest, there's no narrow tailoring, and it makes no sense from a constitutional standpoint to require a greater standard of support for judges than for other offices, which the state of Pennsylvania had seemed to have ranked those in a hierarchy.
Other than Pennsylvania, any of the other 49 states, include us, ever suggested statute like this is unconstitutional?
I'm not sure that another state has. I don't know if another state has such a statute. I cannot represent you that there
appears to be no.
Right. I can't represent there is or isn't.
Of course, you did get pretty close. It's not that huge a requirement to get 50 signatures.
That's correct. And one thing I've said and said in the brief that we haven't come before you saying.
And the fact that the Libertarians get a bye is not usually that big a threat to whoever the Republican or Democratic candidate is, right?
Well, but I don't think that's the constitutional standard.
Yeah, why would that matter? Why would that matter that a minor party is not a threat to a major party?
I think it wouldn't matter. I think that the fact that you treat the minor parties differently and give them essentially a free pass does not matter in the sense of upholding the statute. I think that it matters in that it shows that the standard doesn't make any sense, or the statute doesn't make any sense. It is not narrowly tailored to promote a compelling interest. What is the state's interest here? One possibility is that it is to show some level of support. Another is that it was suggested during some of the questioning in the district court that maybe it's to show that people have some qualification or to demonstrate their qualification. Well, first on the latter, there's nothing about gathering signatures that deals with qualifications. And whether you're a qualified judge or not is not going to be determined by how many signatures you get. So it gets down to a question of support, and certainly, you know, I think that a Libertarian or some other camp party that qualifies to be on the ballot does not have that support. And if we're going to show it, then we need to show it uniformly across the board, or require it uniformly across the board.
On your second point, if the statute, if we assume the statute's constitutional, why should you get on the ballot with 45 signatures?
If the statute is constitutional, obviously we're 5 signatures short. In the Gamble case, this court recognized that because of the provision of the code that says that you can get equitable relief, that there is the option for obtaining such relief by opening up and giving people the chance to correct. Now, the whole statute is designed that way. It's designed to have the party officials review matters as quickly as practicable, to let you know. And in fact, that's what happened here. Judge Holcomb filed on the 28th. On the 29th, the party had reviewed his petitions and had said, you qualify. Essentially, at that point, the game was over for him. He knew that he had qualified. He didn't have to worry about it anymore. As it turned out, after the filing period had closed, 5, 6, 7 days later, they call him and say, by the way, you don't qualify. Now,
so if, same with me, a candidate made up 50 names, just fraudulent, sure. Made up 50 names, gave it to the party early enough, the party approves it. Same result as what you're arguing for? The party approved it? The party didn't say anything? I could have gotten 50 more signatures?
I think fraud might be a different situation if you could show fraud, but there certainly is no fraud here. I mean, I don't think anyone has suggested that, and that is not the case. But the statute is designed to give you the chance to fix the problems. And the problem here is not, and I have not argued that 700 signatures or 50 signatures in a particular locale is a particularly onerous requirement. What's onerous about it is that it's an obstacle course. If we wanted to say, let's show support by showing how many signatures you can get, or that you have to get 1,000 or 2,000 or some number of signatures, that's one thing. But to say they have to come 50 from here, 50 from here, 50 from here, and 50 from here, and when you do it on a crazy quilt system, which I think the judicial districts...
Well, this part of your argument, we've already moved on from constitutionality to the minimum level of signatures taken. Now, this part of your argument is a legislative argument, is it not? One that you make to the legislature in determining how you require the signatures to be taken across the state. It's a you're making a policy argument that this patchwork quilt doesn't make sense, but isn't that an argument that you make to elected representatives who are drafting the statute instead of to the court?
Your Honor, yes, and but also as to the constitutionality, if it doesn't make sense, if it's not narrowly tailored, you can't frustrate a fundamental right by putting something in that is not narrowly tailored to address that right, and it is not here.
Are you contending that this is a facial defect? Because in Gamble, we did put a lot of responsibility on the candidate themselves to check these petitions, and only in the event of a facial sort of defect is easily catchable does the equity piece kick in.
This was a facial defect, and nobody had to go behind the signatures to find it.
So your argument rises or falls upon our finding this to be a facial defect?
On the...
non-constitutional.
On the non-constitutional.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the relator for Robert Francis.
May it please the court. Applying this court's analysis in N. Ray Bell, the omission of place 8 from 11 pages of Judge Francis's 225-page petition does not undermine the election code's place number requirement, because there is no evidence of election fraud or voter confusion or the invalidation of any voter signature due to his or her signing more than one candidate's petition. Thus, invalidating the challenge signatures is not a just and reasonable result in light of these statutory purposes. Alternatively, if these signatures are invalid, then balancing the competing equities under N. Ray Gamble should result in Judge Francis receiving equitable relief from the statutory deadline.
What significance, if any, does Gamble have on this court in light of the fact that it was a 4-4-1 decision?
I don't believe it was a plurality decision except as to one paragraph. Judge Phillips did not participate in paragraph 2B. Otherwise, he was on the majority opinion. So I believe there is a majority with respect to the court recognizing that the legislature had given it equitable powers over decisions under the election code and in connection with under certain circumstances where the competing, the balancing the competing equities justifies relief to a candidate from the statutory deadlines, that is the law of this court in stare decisis.
Do we really want to call petition signers in and start questioning them in court? I mean, in Bell, for example, it was independently verifiable, the signer's addresses. You didn't have to go to the signer, make them raise their hand. And is this a good road to go down to start hauling in petition signers to see what their intent was after the fact?
I don't think that you have to haul them in under these circumstances. Your Honor, I think that the court's question in N. Ray Bell, whether invalidating the signatures is a just and reasonable result in light of the object sought to be obtained by the statute, applies in this particular case. And I believe that on this record, without having called any voter in, and looking at the entirety of the petition, which this court recognized was the appropriate way to do it, we can ascertain from the face of the petitions that there was no election fraud, there was no voter confusion, and that the provisions of the election code which would have invalidated the signature of a voter who signed for more than one candidate running for the same office in the same election did not happen.
But how can we tell whether someone didn't say, sign this for Judge Francis, he's running for this place, and then later change that and say, he's running for presiding judge.
Because
and then it doesn't say on there, and then when they get the petition back, they change it to place six.
Well, because there was no change here. We have the omission. I mean, we know there was not. And that's the type of election fraud, Your Honor, that I believe if there was evidence in the record, then if you applied the N. Ray Bell test, you might reach a different result.
But then coming to Judge O'Neill's question, how can we tell without calling all these people in and say, what were you telling?
Because you can look at this stack, and you can see that out of 225 pages, there are 11 that do not say place 8 on them. And if you read the record from the hearing in this case, you know that there was no voter confusion and no election fraud.
How do we know that from the record? I thought I heard you say that you can look at the other candidates' signatures on file, and if there are no overlapping signatures, you don't have to haul the signers in.
Well, the reason why I say that, Your Honor, is that with respect to place number on the petitions, the legislature has addressed the circumstances under which a signature is invalidated. And it's invalidated if you sign more than one petition. The later signature is invalid. So I would suggest to the court that under the test in N. Ray Bell, if our record reflected that, in fact, someone had signed Representative Keel's petition after Judge Francis and he lost signatures that would have otherwise qualified him for the ballot, then under your N. Ray Bell test, we would have a different result. Or similarly, if, in fact, And Judge Francis caused that circumstance with his petitions. That's why I think on the face of the petitions and on this particular record, you can see that the object of the statute, which was what this court focused on in N. Ray Bell, is accomplished by recognizing that these petitions, in the context of the totality of the petition, that there is no evidence on the face of voter fraud nor voter confusion.
Is it possible on those 11 pages that the person signing those petitions in his or her own mind was thinking, I'll sign this petition for Francis as long as he's not running against Keel?
Well,
or as long, I mean, so that it was important to that voter what the place number was.
Well,
and
excuse me.
And, you know, the person gathering the signatures made a misrepresentation that it's not clear to us from the record, you know, what was stated.
Well, first of all, the election code required the person getting the signatures to tell the person what they were signing. We have nothing in the record to indicate that that was not followed in this particular instance.
Well, I mean, that sort of begs the question because it tells them what they're supposed to sign, but it's all supposed to say that at the top as well.
I understand, Your Honor, and
we are not here.
But we also are required, there's also required to be an evidentiary record in the face of
this. And the evidence in this case is not that I read it to them.
I agree. The person did not come in to say that. I'm just talking about the fact that looking at the totality of the statutory scheme.
Who's got the burden of presenting that evidence? Challenger?
I think the challenger, given the fact that under these circumstances the party had made the decision and had given notice to Judge Francis that he was going on the ballot. In fact, Representative Keel went into court to change the status quo. In order to do that, I believe that he had the burden to show that the signatures were invalid.
So assume he comes into court with one person who says, I didn't know it was for place 8. I wouldn't have signed if I'd known it was for place 8. Then we would have a fact question. Judge Dietz could decide whether to issue the injunction or not, whether there was voter fraud.
Well, I think that perhaps under, if you change the facts to that, Justice Brister, then you may spill over into a gamble situation. I think that what the court has done in the two decisions, In re Bell and In re Gamble, is we are dealing with the legal questions under the election code with statutory interpretation under the construct of In re Bell. Then the court set up a construct for equitable considerations if, in fact, it was going to exercise its equitable power. So I think that what we have is very much a case-by-case analysis with appropriate parameters set up by the court under either construct.
Well, but so in Bell, you could tell, if you took the petitions and went and looked it up, you could tell where everybody lived, at least what the records show. And in Gamble, nobody was confused but the party. There was no possibility of public confusion. This is the first case that we've had where there's a possibility of public confusion.
Well, but we have evidence in this record that there was no public confusion because we, in fact, have the woman who had those petitions signed in the Tyler Court of Appeals jurisdiction that she submitted within 2.5 hours. She went back to most of the same voters. They re-signed the petitions with Place 8 on them. And that is in the record in this case. So the truth is that we do have evidence in this case that there was no voter confusion.
Objected to.
There seems to be an argument that the statute provides a safety net for those candidates who filed December the 2nd as opposed to January the 2nd. Does it really matter if they file December the 2nd or the very last day? If you file December the 2nd and the party doesn't catch the mistake?
No, it does not matter. There, under In re Gamble, the court recognized two statutory duties. The first for the party to timely do the review, and second of all, to immediately notify in writing the candidate of any deficiencies. The party in this instance believed these petitions were okay. If they were wrong, they committed a mistake of law. If the court disagrees with our first argument, and in fact they failed to meet their second statutory duty, which is to immediately notify him of the deficiency. This record reflects that had Judge Francis been told either that the petitions were invalid or that there was a question raised, that within 2.5 hours he could have corrected the issue. He filed 4 days before the end of the deadline. So if we bound, and I think that the emphasis that Representative Keel places on the file your petitions on December 2nd under In re Gamble is overblown. In here, if you balance the equities and do all of the things that In re Gamble talks about, the competing equities come down absolutely on the side of Judge Francis being allowed to be on the ballot.
We heard this morning some about the reason for the signature requirement. What are the legislative goals sought to be achieved by this?
The legislative goal, as reflected by the House legislative history that we have, was to show statewide support for the candidate. That does not mean I'm going to vote for the candidate, but that, in fact, the candidate has enough credibility, recognition of their qualifications statewide, characterize it however you would, to justify putting them on the ballot. Enough voters in Texas want this person on the ballot.
There's also a statute that precludes the same signer from signing for more than one candidate for the same office. So that has to be another purpose of the 50-signature requirement, to allow the voter to decide which candidate he or she wants to support by helping them get on the ballot.
That's correct, Rob. And in this particular instance, Judge Francis had 1,710 signatures when he only needed 700. He had 122 in Tyler in the Tyler Court of Appeals jurisdiction before they were struck. He started getting signatures in September. He filed 4 days early, regularly communicated with the party to make sure he didn't need to do anything else. He was able to get substitute petitions in 2.5 hours, which could have been put in had he been timely told, or he could have supplemented if he knew there was a question.
I think it's fair to say, in reading Gamble, that the parameters of this sort of equity requirement are not very well established. I would say there's a plurality on that. Yes, there's a majority that equity can be considered, but the four-judge plurality said very strict. It's very rare. So I think we're, again, testing the parameters of this equity remedy.
Well, I've been through this list so far, and I think another factor in this has to be the fact that Representative Keel I'm not attributing to him any kind of ill intent. But on Friday morning, he recognized, according to the record, that there was, quote, a serious problem, as did his lawyer. And I think the question is, under In re Gamble, is this court going to send a message to candidates that it is okay, that it is okay to wait until 30 minutes before the filing deadline when it's clear legislative intent was to allow for correction?
But it seems like we've got a clear statute that says here's what the candidate has to do. And, you know, we try to put some fault on the or blame on the party chair, and we try to foist it off on the other candidates who were testing these petitions. It strikes me that if you can determine objectively without hauling in signers, then maybe that would be a stricter parameter for equity. And if that's the case, how would you ensure that there's no if the interest sought to be protected is that the voter knows what spot they're running for so they won't sign another petition, how can you objectively establish an objective test to be able to make sure that doesn't happen?
I think the objective test is the fact that the voter didn't sign another petition. I mean that to me is a critical fact in this particular case, whether you're looking at the statutory construct under In re Bell or whether you're looking at In re Gamble.
Well, that's not going to be very probative, though, counsel. There's 12 million voters in Texas. You have to get 50 signatures in each of 14 districts. To say that those 50 signers didn't sign another petition is evidence that they weren't interested in signing another petition doesn't tell us a whole lot. There's a very small chance that you're going to get the same 50 when you've got 12 million possible voters out there.
Well, but I think that answers the question, though, that someone was not interested in signing another person's petition, and, in fact, they were showing support. I think at bottom, when you look at the equities test and you line them all up under In re Gamble, this is a case that certainly justifies the equities. There are no equities that cut the other way, given the legislature's intent on wanting these corrections to be made. And I think you have to follow up and remember that what is at bottom.
Let me jump in here again with another question. Should the court be very cautious in implying equitable exceptions to mandatory statutes? Shouldn't we be very cautious in doing that?
I think that's what the court said in In re Gamble, that the court was going to be careful, and I agree with Justice
specifically
O'Neill.
Specifically as to extending the deadline, I'm speaking generally.
And I agree with Justice O'Neill that what the court did was agree that it had the equitable power to do it. It did not have the record in that case to be able to make the decision whether to allow it in that case or not. There was one paragraph in which there was some dicta or indication of what the court might do, which Chief Justice Phillips did not join into. But the power is there. And balancing competing equities in this case puts Justice Francis's position way up here with nothing controverting. And you have to put in the hopper on the balancing test the rights and interests of the voters in electing candidates of their choice. Texas law has traditionally elevated the rights of voters, and in this case, the rights of voters will be jeopardized if Judge Francis is not on the ballot.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any further questions?
I don't think this is in your brief, nor do I think it's your argument, but I'd like to know what your thoughts are on the constitutionality of this statute.
Candidly, Justice Medina, I apologize for not being prepared on that, but I really have not evaluated Judge Holcomb's position on that and would be uncomfortable offering an opinion on it.
And my question is, and I've got to ask you,
okay.
you argue that In re Bell governs this case, and under In re Bell, your client wins. With your judicial hat on, you dissented in In re Bell. Can you explain that for us?
Well,
I know you've thought about it.
And I lost in In re Gamble too. They were both 7-2 decisions with Justice Baker. No, I think Gamble was closer, but In re Bell was a 7-2 decision, and I joined Justice Baker in dissent because I was, you know, I felt like that I had a different view of the statute. However, because I lost, In re Bell is now the binding precedent of this court, and since this court pledges its allegiance to stare decisis, my job here as an advocate, and it would be if I were still a judge, would be to adhere to In re Bell.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
May it please the court, Ms. Donna G. Davidson will present argument for real parties in interest, the Republican Party of Texas, and Tina J. Benkiser, chairwoman of the Republican Party of Texas. Mr. Patrick Keel will present argument for real party in interest, Terry Keel.
May it please the Court. The Republican Party of Texas needs to respond to both Holcomb and Francis situations. They were determined differently because they were different situations. One was a case of a deficiency in signatures for which there was case law that then indicates that duplicates should not be counted toward the total required. That's in Cohen versus Raines. However, in the Francis case, N. Ray Bell arguably would apply because petitions were involved, not just the applications. We do not, yes.
Counsel, did the party certify Judge Robert Francis? The transcript of the hearing suggests that one point that it did, another point perhaps it didn't. The statute seems to contemplate a difference between certifying a candidate by the Republican Party of Texas or the other major party, the Democratic Party, versus sending the certified list to the county chairs. Does the party see it that way? And if so or if not, when was Robert Francis certified by the party?
A most excellent question.
Thank you.
For the following reasons, I will give you a timeline and you can see where the confusion will lie. On January 6th, the determination was made to certify Judge Francis. When the decision was made internally.
The determination was made.
Yes.
He was certified.
But nothing had been relayed to the Secretary of State's office. That is a separate step.
Okay. Was he certified January 6th?
No, the certification list did not go out until January 9th.
I'm drawing a distinction between when you send the list versus when you certified him. If that's the way you do business. So when did you certify him?
We stated that we had certified him in a letter to him on January 6th.
The letter was sent out on January 6th?
Yes, sir, I believe so.
Right, you rejected Mr. Keel's challenge.
In response to Mr. Keel's challenge.
So you rejected one of Mr. Keel's challenges, you accepted the other.
That is correct.
How does that distinguish the cases? Is there any distinction between those cases at this court now that the party sustained one challenge and overruled the other? What difference should that make in the legal analysis?
Well, in legal analysis, we believe that the certification in light of N. Ray Bell would conceivably been correct because it was a petition issue and it was on the face of the ballot where other determinations had been made regarding...
I'm not arguing about whether you were right or wrong. I think
understood.
We'll eventually decide that.
Yes, but sir.
Shouldn't there be a difference between a case? I'm wondering whether the burden of proof ought to be on one party to prove that the party's wrong, whether it certifies or doesn't certify. Shouldn't there be some effect to the party's decision? Or is it your position that it just doesn't matter what the party does?
It does matter what the party does, and the party tried to make the best decision available, understanding that it could be subject to challenge either way. If we had chosen not to certify, then the challenge would probably have come from Judge Francis to get on the ballot. If we chose to certify, which we did, then we knew that Keel would then oppose that as well. The difficulty was in trying to interpret whether it was going to be a strict construction standard or N. Ray Bell type of standard, substantial compliance standard, not knowing where the line would be drawn.
If Mr. Keel had stopped after receiving your decision, then the fact of the matter is, and Judge Dietz had never been involved, Judge Francis would be on the ballot and Judge Holcomb would not, correct?
Yes.
So when Judge Dietz said neither one's on the ballot, he changed the status quo, didn't he?
Because of our decision to certify, that would be correct, made on January 6th. However, in our representations to Judge Dietz, because the certified list had not gone out, we determined that we could conditionally, and we represented that we could conditionally certify Judge Francis because ballots would not have been printed yet, ballot placement would not have been drawn for, and the practical effect would be that we could conditionally certify. However, we discovered later with the electronic system we were not able to conditionally certify. So we either had to certify or not and keep everyone apprised of the fact that it was subject to change.
Before you sit down, I want to, these election contests, time is of the essence, and there are competing ideas about what is the last day that this court has to act. I mean, we'll certainly attempt to act expeditiously, but when will the ballots be printed? When does early voting start? What is the crisis point?
It is my understanding at this point that the Secretary of State has sent out a memo to Republican county chairs as of yesterday or day before. I do not have a copy of it, but I've been informed of this, has advised people not to print the ballots. Requests for ballots can be made at any time. At this point, early voting starts on February 21st. Therefore, if everything is decided in a timely fashion before February 20th, there is still time, legally speaking, to handle it. Practically speaking, it would be difficult because there are still counties that have paper ballots. Electronically, for those counties that are larger, that probably is a possibility. In consultation with the Secretary of State, when I asked, and February 20th was the, quote, deadline, practically speaking, it has to be sometime, probably the week before, to give enough time for the actual ballots to be printed and received.
Ms. Davidson, speaking legally and not practically, what is the last date that a challenge could have been made to either Judge Holcomb or Judge Francis's filings?
Actually, I believe that is an open legal question. There have been challenges that have taken place after, in a primary situation, I am not sure. I do not have an answer to that. I know that in general elections, there have been cases that have been decided quite late, but there is also a deadline there as well of August 25th for this year if somebody were to bring a challenge to the general election nominee. But I'm not sure of what that would be in the primary.
Is it passed yet? As of the time we sit here today, is it past time for the
challenge?
No,
actually, again, I don't think there is an actual timeline. Again, in consultation with the Secretary of State, trying to determine if there was one in order to be prepared for that question, we were told that technically we could still reject applications now. But again, practically speaking, that wouldn't make too much sense.
All right, so practically speaking, sometimes it's going to take a back seat to legally speaking. And I guess if a challenge is made after you say you practically can't get the ballots, so there's a little problem, this court would still, or any court would still have to deal with the challenge, even though the ballots have been printed.
Yes, and then it would then need either to order that the ballot name be stricken, or I believe even stickers, adhesive stickers have been used to add names to ballots previously if the ballots had already been printed.
So if in fact the challenge could be made up until the time of early voting started, for example, then if we're talking about what the court can do, any challenger would see, in order to avoid having hearings and things, would wait until the very last day, maybe?
That is possible.
If we start extending deadlines and things, then what's going to happen to the party, it seems like, is going to happen the last day. You're going to get a raft of challenges throughout the state, are you not?
The last thing that we would want, Judge, is that to happen. The fewer challenges, the better. It is very difficult to notify over 200 county party chairs of changes. We have had to do so. It is a lot more simple a process, even though it's an onerous task and time-consuming. We can do it early on in the process because ballot placement drawing meetings have not yet necessarily been held at that point, or even if they have, there's still a chance to just draw for that place. And again, my understanding is that letter went out either a day or two ago.
When a party reviews the application, does the party look for substantial compliance with the statute or strict compliance to the letter of the law?
Generally, strict compliance.
What happens when a party accepts an application and the signatures don't contain and voter registration number?
At one point in time, in 2002, the Republican Party of Texas was challenged by Michael Fetland, and that was one of the questions involved. And the voter registration number was deemed to be unconstitutional by Judge Sparks. But that had been something that had been required, and Mr. Fetland had been kicked off the ballot for that reason, was not allowed to be on the ballot for that reason. N. Ray Bell came down the same time as that court case. So those signatures that didn't have city or state or
zip code
also then were, after that argument, found to be valid, so that placed him.
Why does the party make that a requirement on his petition gathering process?
The Secretary of State guidelines show that the voter registration number should be included, and of course, if under N. Ray Bell all you have is the voter registration number and name, then you can determine potentially where that person lives by going off the face of the petition.
I take it the party's job is, at least in part, to assist candidates in meeting all these technical requirements.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it Ms. Florkey? Is that her name?
Ms. Florkey.
And is she correct that, in fact, everybody submits three or four times the statutory number of signatures because everybody makes mistakes on these?
I don't recall that in her testimony, but yes, generally speaking, in order to avoid these problems, you try to...
There are always problems on different applications. I have a transcript saying when you collect judicial petition signatures, you collect so many over the required amount, then in case there's one that I found you're not able to count signatures, you usually have enough. The fact of the matter is the legislature said 50 signatures.
Yes.
And everybody is collecting hundreds of signatures because of technical errors.
Yes.
What purpose does that fulfill?
I think by them gathering an over, beyond, above and beyond the number of signatures required, that no matter how many are invalidated, you would still
need the minimum requirement. So the purpose of the statute was to get candidates only who were good copy editors, so that they made no technical mistakes. That's what the legislature intended.
No, the legislature intended broad support. And
is that what, but is everybody is getting far more because everybody makes mistakes.
Even Judge Holcomb in my conversation letting him know about the duplicate signatures had said and represented to me that he had more petitions he could have provided.
And in fact, in this case, if you had... if the party had let the either candidate know, well, the party did let the candidate know before the deadline, the party would have no objection to them submitting additional and curing that error.
That would be no problem. They would actually have to receive the petitions and then add to it and then resubmit all of it again. But that would not have been a problem. If the candidates reviewed the filings as closely as their opposition candidates would be reviewing them, as the party of personal responsibility, we would probably see far fewer challenges.
Did you just suggest that supplementation of petition signatures is not allowed?
No, supplementation.
Except upon withdrawal. Then there's a provision in the statute for supplementation.
I believe that is correct.
So otherwise, you can't supplement the petition. You need to refile the entire petition.
Correct. And
that assumes that your office accepts copies then. I mean, if you have to refile the entire petition, you can't refile the original twice.
Actually,
the original's been filed already.
It would probably be, practically speaking, fine if somebody came up to Sarah Flerke and she had rejected it and they said, let me come up, I will take that from you. She could deliver it back to them with their check. They could then put in the new petitions and fill out a new application and refile it, conceivably within minutes.
So,
if they had already gathered the signatures.
So your understanding is supplementation of petitions is not allowed.
Correct.
And the original has to be filed.
Yes, sir. I believe so.
Judge Holcomb and Judge Francis each had explanations for how this happened. Did you learn those explanations before you acted on the applications?
No, we had not been able to contact either Judge Francis or Judge Holcomb prior to making our determinations to certify. Once we had contacted Judge Francis, and actually we received an affidavit in my office later indicating that one of the circulators did indicate that Place 8 had been mentioned, that they had mentioned that the opponent for that place was Terry Keel. and it was not offered into evidence.
Did that make any difference to the side?
It helped us understand how N. Ray Bell could potentially be the standard and supported that position. However, again, strict construction is not something that we're adverse to.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Board is ready to hear argument from the real party of interest, Terry.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin by picking up with Gamble. To the extent Gamble applies at all in this case, I think the critical fact here is the evidence that was before the district court on whether or not the party carried out its duty under the statute. The party has a duty incumbent on the reviewing person at the party to review those applications and petitions carefully. What do we know about what happened here? Sarah Flerke and the other people in her office that assist her, and I'm reading her testimony, do the best job they can in examining those applications and those petitions and making sure they are correct. They make sure they comply with the letter of the law, was her testimony. They do as good a job as they can because they're very conscientious about those legal requirements. And her own personal goal is to get it done the same day, but because judicial applications include the petition, sometimes she's not able to meet that goal. Now, why does that matter? Here's why it matters. To the extent Gamble is the law, I respectfully suggest to the court there is absolutely no opportunity to apply Gamble here because there's no demonstration, no evidence that the party failed to discharge its duty under the election code. And unless the court is going to construe Gamble and the election code to mean that the party is a guarantor of the accuracy of the application and the petition, there is no way that you can even get to a Gamble analysis in this case. I respectfully
What's your response to their theory of unclean hands doctrine applying to your situation?
My answer to that argument, Justice Medina, is the testimony of Ed Schack, the election lawyer expert who is Terry Keel's advisor on these kinds of matters. His testimony was he worked as fast as he could. Representative Keel delivered a copy of Francis's and Holcomb's applications and petitions to him late in the afternoon on Friday the 30th. The next day was New Year's Eve, and Mr. Schack had family in town, and it was a holiday. He got to it on Sunday, however. He rolled up his sleeves, and he reviewed the petitions. He reviewed the case law to satisfy himself that there was a problem. He was also busy.
And then he called 30 minutes before the deadline was over. The fact of the matter is, if somebody had said, by the way, place 8 is missing, which was the only reason Mr. Keel copied these, on this record, indisputably, it could have been cured before the deadline.
What I know is this, Justice Brisker. Mr. Schack said, I was operating under the rule that I know because I live and breathe this election code, that time was of the essence, and that's exactly what I did.
Lawyers are always busy. The fact of the matter is, the only reason Mr. Keel made copies of the petitions was because he saw place 8 was missing on a few.
Fair enough.
Could have said that at the moment. If he had said that at the 28th, we wouldn't be here because Judge Francis would have fixed it, right?
Justice Brister, I think the gist of the testimony before the district judge was Representative Keel goes and looks at those and sees, oh my goodness, he didn't put
I've read the record. I need an answer to my question.
I'm sorry, I'm trying
If he had said when he took the copies, the reason I'm making copies is because place 8 is missing, the party had a duty to immediately notify Judge Francis. Indisputably on this record, Judge Francis would have fixed it, and Judge Francis would be a candidate, correct?
Correct. If the party had actual knowledge of the mistake and chose to ignore it,
that would be a failure. Shouldn't we construe the law in a way that puts people on the ballot rather than kicks people off the ballot?
I don't think there is a problem with construing the law to put people on the ballot.
Shouldn't we construe the law in a way that gets technical errors corrected before the deadline rather than 2 days after the deadline?
No, sir. I think if you construe the law to adjust and say something other than what the black letter of the election code says, absent a dereliction of duty by a party official, if you do that, Justice Brister, you invite mayhem.
So what if all 50 people from all 14 districts come to Judge Dietz's court and say, of course we intended to sign for Judge Francis to be on place 8, is it your position then that we should, because of misspellings, clerical errors, or whatever, we should ignore the facts and toss Canada off the ballot?
You're not ignoring the facts, because the fact is that had to happen before 6 o'clock on January 2nd. And if that had happened before 6 o'clock on January 2nd, we would not be here.
Mr. Gill, let me follow up. One of the things that concerns me here about Gamble is the parameters you apply to this equitable analysis. What sort of standard of review is there on what the trial court does? For example, I understand your response to Justice Brisker's question is the trial court heard the unclean hands argument and rejected it. Do we review that de novo? What sort of deference do we give the trial court if, in fact, this equity standard applies?
I believe it's an abuse of discretion standard, Justice O'Neill, because...
Which leads me to...
Yes, ma'am.
Then it sort of throws these cases into whatever judge you happen to draw.
Well, you say that as though that is an indictment of the system that's been set up by the legislature, but respectfully, the election code plainly says that a person who is aggrieved or even threatened by a possible violation of the election code is entitled to seek injunctive relief.
I think I'm helping you here.
And I'll be quiet.
I think one of the problems with this equity argument is it's just subject to, it's so interpretational.
I see what you're saying.
That you can get different results according to wherever you go, and not casting aspersions on any individual trial court judge, but they may have different views of how strictly the code should be read.
I apologize. I see your point, and I guess I was I'm here to defend the exercise of discretion by Judge Deep specifically, obviously, in this case. But I think you're exactly right, because I think the last thing this court or the trial courts of the state want to be doing is wrestling with these election code cases every time we have an election, and that's what's happening.
Okay, so let me follow up now. If what we want is some sort of objective test, where we don't have to haul voters in and determine credibility of what different candidates did when, and unclean hands and things like that, then why can't we have a test? Because we do have Gamble. It says equity does have to be taken into account to reach a fair and just result. And we crossed a bit of a threshold there by making that statement, or at least five judges on the court did. What would be wrong with a test that says if you can objectively look and determine that no voter was misled? Because the object of this is not to mislead signers of petitions. If you can look at it objectively and determine that no one was misled without taking any evidence at all, then why shouldn't we put Judge Francis on the ballot?
Because in this case, you can't objectively make that determination.
And why not? Because if we look at the other ones,
right,
there are no double signatures.
Right.
If the code itself has a provision that says first signed is the good one, why can't we objectively determine?
Because if that is the law, if that catch-all at the end that the second signed one makes the first one invalid, if that's the rule, then you would swallow every requirement of what has to be on the petition, what the signer has to provide by that catch-all. I was trying to think of an analogy in preparation for exactly that argument, and I think that argument, if you carry it to its logical conclusion, is a little bit like saying, don't worry about violating the law or committing a crime because the executive can always pardon you. Well, clearly, that doesn't make sense. The reason for
I still don't, I'm not sure I understand why, I mean, the statute itself chose to say first sign prevails, so it seemed to contemplate someone signing more than one. They didn't have to put that in there.
But you're punished if you do that. And there is in fact, on the form, because it's required by the code to be there, a warning to the voter that says, you cannot sign more than one petition
for
it.
No, it doesn't say that on the warning. It says it in the statute. The warning says you can't, if you sign, you can't participate in the election of another party. So there's nothing on the face of what has to be read that says you can't sign another petition.
Respectfully, it is there. And indeed, the statute says it must be there. You are correct. There is also a warning about not participating in another party's primary, but it is also there that says this warning has to be on the form.
So what if
and the form has it?
What does the petition say? CCA place 8.
That's okay.
Some of us say that. Why if it says CCA place 8 on?
Because
it doesn't actually say the office sought.
Because I think CCA is a conventional abbreviation that most reasonable people would be able to look at and understand.
So we have to, in fact, it matters whether the voters knew what they were doing or not.
Precisely, and that's why this is critical.
So if it says, suppose the evidence in front of Judge Dietz is Court of Criminal Appeals, no place. But every voter comes in and says, they had this big number 8 right behind the person signing the petition. They said it's for place 8. So, oh, boy, that's the place we want for Judge Francis, place 8. No question. The voters, indisputable facts, my hypothetical, the voters all knew what they were doing, but your position is we toss them off because we can't tell that from looking at the sheet.
Your hypothetical makes it hard for me to argue that would be a just result. And I must concede that on a record like that, it would be hard for me to be here. I will submit this as well, Justice Brister. If this were the kind of – I don't think this ever can happen, that we would just have one candidate for a Court of Criminal Appeals on the ballot. But if this were an office where place number didn't make a difference, or if this year there weren't 3 candidates running for the Court of Criminal Appeals, we only had one place, Representative Keel would not be here. Representative Keel would not have made the challenge, because I think that would get you into a Bell analysis where – it would be perfectly legitimate for the court or any court that heard it to say, well, look, that doesn't make a difference. It is not a distinction this year because there's only one spot up, if you see my point. And so we wouldn't be here if those were the facts. And if the facts as you posed them in your hypothetical were the facts, I agree. You know, I think the state of the law, I think this court's jurisprudence and the election code over the last decade or so can be summarized this way. Yeah, it's still strict construction, but we're going to avoid, if we can, by equity, an unjust or even an absurd result.
Well, there's a little tension, though, isn't there? And for 40 years, we said strict construction.
Yes, sir.
Right down the line. And
yes,
we haven't said that in 15 years. And then about 40 years ago, we started saying construe against ineligibility. And we've been saying that a lot recently. Do you think one has eclipsed the other?
I think you have opened a Pandora's box, respectfully. I think Gamble is problematic. As precedent, I question its precedential value because there was only a plurality on the key section of Justice Enoch's opinion. I think Justice Baker's dissent in Gamble was right on the money. I think your dissent, Justice Head, in the Fitch case, Fitch versus 14th Court of Appeals, which arose out of Justice O'Neill's situation in Harris County, I think you were exactly right. The law is the law, and any reasonable lawyer or person.
But if the record here establishes that everybody makes these, everybody does 3 times what they need because they know everybody makes these, and yet every election cycle lately, 3 or 4 or 5 people are struck off the ballot for technical errors. Isn't that a rather whimsical form of democracy, where every election we take 100 candidates, we throw the dice, and 5 of you at random are off, and the rest can run?
I would agree with you if the requirements were onerous, but here the requirements are not onerous.
Compared to the Green Party, they're onerous. Compared to the Libertarian Party, they're onerous.
Well, in fact, on the
which I want to ask you about the Constitution.
Okay.
Issue.
And I think on, if you'd like me to address that now, I will.
I think you better finish just.
I'm sorry.
Question.
Did I not?
No, I'm just. If the requirements, if it's all easy, then it makes no sense that everybody's getting 120 signatures. Everybody's getting 120 signatures when they need 50 because they know it is not easy.
But, Justice Brister, I think citing the fact that people get more than they need, that somehow that's become the state purpose, I don't think that's correct, because you're just citing the fact that people are being prudent. And I think any good candidate is going to do as good. For example, lawyers, when they have a deadline, you know, I don't want to file my motion for new trial, which, as we all know, is a critical deadline that affects whether you can even have an appeal. A good lawyer probably doesn't wait until the deadline, the day of that's due to do it. You try to do it in advance. Well, does that mean the deadline's really not 30 days? It's 25? Well, no.
So, but you're making the argument that prudent people never make mistakes. If prudent people never made mistakes, we wouldn't need nunk-pro-tunk orders in courts, because even courts make mistakes. And there's nothing stronger in courts about when the plenary jurisdiction is over, it's over. And yet, for 100 years, we've had nunk-pro-tunks that can be done after you lose jurisdiction because courts make mistakes.
Here's where your equity analysis, I think, is legitimate. If the candidate, despite his or her best efforts to comply, falls short and the party is somehow complicit in failing to bring it to his attention because the party didn't do a diligent job reviewing the application and the petition, there's room there for
equity. But in this case, after you brought it to their attention, they still certified Judge Francis.
They made the initial determination that they would do so.
They made one determination and certified, and they said, but look at these particular pages.
Well,
the party looked at those pages again, and they said, certified again.
What your record and the brief from the party demonstrate to you is the party, frankly, can understand what the letter of the law required and would not have certified Francis but for its concerns about Bell and Gamble, which have opened a Pandora's box.
I do have something I want to ask you. I found the language in the petition. It's not important enough, I suppose, for them to require it be read, but it is at the very top. The
yes,
signing
ma'am.
Of the petition of more than one candidate for the same office in the same election is prohibited. Presuming everyone who signed this read that, then they know I can't sign for another office, for another person in the same office. And they didn't. If you look at the other petitions, they didn't do that. Now, why couldn't we craft an objective test?
Because you can't do that on the face of it. You have to go back and do it after the fact of the January.
You don't have to gather anything else. You just look at the petitions of Holcomb, and you look at the petitions of Keel.
Well, I guess my response to that would be, why have the requirement at all? I mean, it's got to mean something, doesn't it, that the code requires.
But presuming we meant something when we said there's some amount of equity. And if we could tell objectively, because what I have problems with is hauling petition signers
yes.
in.
Yes.
Could we tell from the face of what's on file in public record that really no one was misled here, and so the object sought to be obtained has been served?
But I don't think you can do that because you can't answer the question, were they misled, unless you know that place 8 was on there. It begs the question, if you see what I mean.
Counsel, sounds like you do not dispute that Robert Francis was certified. Judge Robert Francis was certified by the party.
Oh, was I did.
Initially,
they made a determination. They were, as I understood it, as the lawyer who was waiting for their decision, and told them, "I'm waiting for your decision because if you determine you are going to go ahead with certifying him, I'm going to seek a temporary restraining order to keep you from doing that." And candidly, our communications were—we were talking to each other. My understanding, and the understanding Judge Dietz had when the TRO application was presented to him on Saturday, was that the status quo was he wasn't yet certified, that they were going to certify him. And in fact, Judge Dietz recited on the record what his understanding of the events were. It was only because Judge Dietz wanted to give Judge Francis an opportunity to be heard from that nothing was done on Saturday.
Yeah, I understand. The transcript, reading it, it kind of goes back and forth. You were there. I weren't.
Yes, sir.
You can tell a whole lot. As a former trial judge, you and I both know that by being there. But the record says, for instance, Ms. Davidson, pages 48 and 49 of the initial hearing, we would then send out notices to all the county chairs letting them know, in accordance with your opinion, if you decertify him, which presumes he was... To decertify them, that means they have to have been certified once. Ms. Davidson just told us that the party certified him on January 6th. Are you telling us you take issue with her statement?
I believe she misspoke because if you read further...
Now, I don't think she misspoke. The question was put to her several times. She was clear in what she intended. Are you taking issue with what she said?
I am, because I don't think it's accurate, Judge Wainwright. If you read further and Judge Deed sort of summarized how we got to where we were that Monday... It's clear that what was represented to him, and the only reason he didn't sign a TRO on Saturday was we could wait until 3:30 on Monday when he scheduled the hearing, and we would be in the same situation because the party agreed to stand down.
Would you briefly address Justice Medina's question about constitutionality?
Certainly. I think for you to engage in the merits of the constitutional argument that Judge Holcomb has brought, you would have to have a different party, because Judge Holcomb's own testimony indicated that, respectfully, he himself made absolutely no effort to comply with the statutory requirements. And for him to make the argument that they are unduly burdensome is totally inconsistent with his own conduct, and you will see that in his testimony. On the merits of the argument, the Pennsylvania case, I think that can be distinguished so easily it is almost laughable, because in that case, statewide candidates in Pennsylvania were required to gather 56,000 signatures. And we're talking about what the Pennsylvania court was offended by was not that they were treating judicial candidates differently from non-judicial candidates. The Pennsylvania law was treating minor parties more harshly than it was treating the Republican and Democratic parties, making it more difficult for the Patriot Party, which is what became of Ross Perot's party in Pennsylvania. It made it harder for them to get more signatures than the so-called mainstream parties, and I think the district judge there was correct to say that's offensive under the Constitution, but that's plainly not the case here.
Isn't it the same situation that Texas has here with an independent that wants to run statewide?
Well, it's easier, as I understand it, for an independent to get on the general election ballot through a convention system rather than have to gather signatures. So it's sort of the reverse. Okay.
Further questions? Thank you.
If I might begin by noting something about the date for action, the question came up to the party representative as to when the court needed to act, and I think the legal deadline was the beginning of early voting, which is, I believe, the 21st of February. As a practical matter, early voting by mail ballots would typically go out the 28th of January.
Is there a deadline after you request a ballot for sending one out?
They are supposed to go out no later than the 38th day before the election, and it's in section 86.004, and I hesitate to go over it because it lists two or three days, and you have to add and subtract days and so forth. But it says the 38th day before the election, and as I computed, that is the 28th of January, is when they are supposed to go out. Now, if the Secretary of State has told people don't print the ballots up, they may go out a little later than that as a practical matter. But that's sort of the time frame that we're working on. I want the court to be aware of that, at least in our view. I take issue talking about the Pennsylvania case and the constitutional issue as to what the Pennsylvania case meant with Mr. Keel. I do not believe the court was offended by treating the major party candidates more generously than the minor party candidates, requiring more votes or more signatures than minor party candidates than the major party. And in fact, courts typically have not had a problem there. As I read the case and have read it very carefully, they were offended by the fact that for the presidential and gubernatorial candidates had to get about half as many signatures as a judicial candidate. Now, this was for minor parties. With the major parties, you didn't have this disparity, or actually there was a disparity, but it was very small, and the governor and the presidential candidate had a higher requirement, and they just mentioned that in passing, but it was an aside. It wasn't the fundamental issue in the case, and it was just saying that they tend to look at the president and the governorship as typically something that would require more, and here with the judicial candidates, you flip that on its head. So it wasn't the difference between major and minor. They were looking specifically at requiring more for the minor or more for the judicial candidates than for the executive offices, and that was the problem that they had. As was mentioned during the questioning, you know, perhaps this statute is giving us a whimsical form of democracy. You have the fact here that certainly it is operating to keep people off the ballot or make it very problematic to get on the ballot in this particular race of three candidates who have filed for that office, who have gone out, have attempted to get the signatures. And by the way, I also reject the characterization that Judge Holcomb did nothing to get the signatures or to try to comply with the statute. That's not the way I read the testimony at all. Obviously, he could have gotten more signatures or whatever. I think in hindsight, any of us could have done that. But he made a very diligent effort to go out to each of the 14 courts of the appeals district and have people gather those signatures.
Yes. The question has come up about whether if we continue down this road, that this court is going to be sitting and hearing these kinds of cases every 2 years and arguing for the strict compliance with the statute, the more objective perspective. And here we're talking about applicants to judicial ballots.
Right.
These are people who are asking the voters of this state to put them on the court to interpret and strictly interpret the laws, which is what we hear about all the time. How do you reconcile that?
Well, I reconcile it by the fact that what the law is designed to do here, and part of the law is that you have to have a compelling interest and you have to have a narrowly tailored approach to meeting that compelling interest, and there is none here. That there is nothing in this law that is consistent with the whatever goal is attempted to be achieved, and because of that, the statute is unconstitutional. I would say it's the duty of the court to determine that it's unconstitutional. And that's what the judges are, you know, that would be the appropriate judicial remedy.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Counsel, was Judge Francis certified by the party? And if so, on what date?
I agree with the party's representation of that, that he was in fact certified, and as Justice Brister said, that the status quo was changed by Judge Dietz's order on that Saturday afternoon.
Is the January 6th letter in the record?
I don't recall that it is, Your Honor, but I would have to double check.
Just what difference does it make if we're going to have a hearing on February the 3rd in regard to an don't we have a hearing scheduled for the 3rd?
There is a permanent injunction hearing. Well, first of all, because the temporary injunction is an abuse of discretion because it changed the status quo. Right. And in the meantime, it has kept Judge Francis off the ballot. So waiting for a permanent injunction hearing is not acceptable under these circumstances.
Well, but isn't that within the time limit for a challenge?
Well, but here's the question. And what I would like to point, can I answer this in response to something you mentioned earlier as well? I think there are two things this court can do to build on its existing jurisprudence and take care of your concern, Justice Johnson, about, you know, what's going to happen up until the last minute and causing upheaval in the election process, and Justice Green, your concern about is the court going to do this for every 2 years. The first thing is, I agree with Justice O'Neill, that an objective standard, which has been set out in Bell, and I think can apply in the Gamble context, is what the court needs to look at. And this is a case where there is no voter misled. We're dealing with a facial defect. We have a record that the statutory purpose is fulfilled. It's an objective standard. But the second aspect of it, which weighs into the Gamble analysis and balancing the equities, is, as we know, these challenges come primarily from an opponent in a race. And yes, the statute allows a challenge to be brought up until the very end of the election cycle. I think what this court should do is say to the candidates in this state, that if you expect to be able to prevail on these challenges and not have the equities weigh against you, then it is incumbent upon you to, at the earliest possible opportunity, review your opponent's petitions and apprise the party immediately of any concern that you have. And that will fulfill the legislature's purpose in making sure that the voters have candidates on the ballot. I don't think there's any question that this court's jurisprudence.
Let me ask, there's no requirement under the statute for an opponent or someone who's going to be potentially harmed to take any action at any particular time. There is a statutory requirement for the party to. So what's to you're going to ask us to impose a new burden?
No, in order for them to get equitable relief. I'm going
to
ask you, in the context of balancing competing equities, I do not believe is it acceptable for a candidate to engage in gamesmanship in order to have the windfall.
What is the purpose of the statute allowing the challenge up until the day before early voting begins then?
Well, because of the fact that we want qualified candidates on the ballot. If there's a problem, then, in fact, it can be dealt with up until the time that the people vote. On the other hand, if what we are dealing with are facial technical defects, which the legislature clearly set up a scheme intending there to be a safety net for candidates, intending for there to be the opportunity to correct, then this court, in connection with its In Re Gamble decision, should send the message that it is incumbent upon you, if you expect to be able to rely on that kind of thing, that you must comport with the legislature's intent. Otherwise, the equities are going to work against you.
Final question on equities. We're talking about an objective test and perhaps not an objective test. What would be the standard of review on either of those? If we were to determine that you can tell it from the face of the petition that no one was misled, then do we review that de novo? Is there anything for the trial court to determine? If it's more of a balancing of the equities, how much deference do we have to give to the trial court?
I think that the legislature gave this court and the Court of Appeals, by giving it the power to issue mandamuses to the party officials with respect to the equities, because you have the mandamus power, you are in the position to apply the mandamus standard.
Clear abuse of discretion.
Yes.
So if we applied a non-objective sort of equitable balancing test, we would have to give a great deal of deference to Judge Dietz's determination.
I don't think that that's the case here in the face of the standards that you have set out in In Re Bell with respect to how the statute is to be interpreted and how the election code is to be applied. And I think that if you do decide Judge Francis's case under In Re Bell, there was a clear abuse of discretion. And the only action we're talking about here with Judge Dietz right now is the fact that he improperly granted an injunction. And our relief asks you to mandamus him to set aside his injunction, but we invoke the election code with respect to getting Judge Francis back on the ballot, which creates a different construct that we are asking that the party representative be mandamus to put him back on the ballot. So what we're dealing with right now with the injunction, the only action Judge Dietz has taken is the injunction to say, party, you need to undo everything that you've done, which is a change of status quo. So I think that that issue's not here. I think that the Gamble and In Re Bell issues are in connection with our request for a mandamus under the election code that this court mandamus the party to put him on the ballot.
Regarding Judge Dietz's order, to give due regard to what he did, it perhaps does show that he was perhaps unclear based on the party's representations, whether Judge Francis had been certified or not. The order does three things. It says, don't certify him if you haven't. If you have, decertify him. And, notwithstanding all that, don't print the ballots. So he kind of set up several layers there. It did perhaps show that he was unclear.
Well, but there's no question that when Representative Keel and his lawyers found Judge Dietz at home on Saturday afternoon without any notice to Judge Francis, that things started happening that changed the status quo. Because at that point in time, and the record reflects, the party was prepared to certify Representative Keel, and they agreed, well, we won't take that action until Monday, and we think we need to notify Judge Francis, who had not been notified at that point in time. So I agree with you. It is a a state of affairs that is a little, but it was a very, very unusual way, I think, for things to have proceeded. But the bottom line is, but for what Judge Dietz did, Judge Francis would be on the ballot. And I think that's the bottom question.
Nothing improper, though, about a judge being asked for an ex parte TRO. There's nothing improper about a judge being asked for an ex parte TRO. That's provided for in our rules. Some counties have local rules that say you can't get an ex parte TRO unless someone's dying. But for the judge to be approached and someone saying ice cream's melting on the truck, we need something heard quickly, and then say, well, get in touch with everybody and set it for Monday, nothing improper about that.
Well, but I would suggest that, you know, the letter went to the party on January 2nd, and there were 4 days where the courthouse was open. And then we end up with the challenge on a Saturday afternoon. Ultimately, I agree, it all came out in the wash because the hearing was held on Monday with Judge Francis, and he was able to hire a lawyer on Monday morning to be there at 3:30 Monday afternoon.
My point in talking about it, though,
is that I do think that that sequence of events reflects a change in status quo, Judge Francis.
As the law exists today, that is Mr. Keel's prerogative. That's Mr. Keel's prerogative
to
file his complaint at any time he desires, or anyone desires to challenge a petition. The onus is not on the challenger. The onus is on the candidate to make sure that they comply with the statute.
I agree, but as Justice Brister said, I wish I could say I'd never made a mistake, and certainly not in terms of dealing with it. Judge Francis reviewed those petitions, and he missed it. I mean, and he's not here saying to the court that he didn't miss that. There's no question. And there's no question that if Representative Keel wanted to challenge, he could.
I think those are two different issues.
I was talking about it in the context, Your Honor, of the fact about what you do with the current tests. And it seems to me that given the legislative intent behind the election code, which is to give candidates every opportunity to take care of technical problems with their petitions, that given that, that if the court follows the rule on In re Gamble and balances competing equities, the court should send the message that it is incumbent upon a candidate to review early and immediately notify to fulfill the legislative intent of allowing corrected ballots rather than trying to get the windfall of an uncontested election when the public policy of this state is the exact to the contrary, and that the voter should have the right to have choices when they go to cast their ballots in an election.
Thank you, counsel. These proceedings have been submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All right.